even in California, women and girls still have to travel long distances to access their reproductive rights. Even in California. Even in California, though we're changing it, you still have women and girls that can't afford the copays for procedures and care. That will change in January, even in California. Can you imagine how so many others are suffering in all these other states?
Governor Gavin Newsom speaking today at Planned Parenthood in Los Angeles. People from other states may travel here for the procedure if the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade this summer, as the leaked draft opinion released this week suggests it is ready to do. 13 states already have passed something called a trigger law, and that means they have laws ready to go into effect soon after the decision is released. And one of those states is Utah. Carrie Galloway is the CEO and president of the Planned Parenthood Association of Utah. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you.
What have you heard from people just in the last 24 hours as this has become a major news story in Utah?
We've heard a lot. And last night, Planned Parenthood and a number of our sister organizations put together a very quick rally at the Capitol. We put our permit in for 200 people. And my understanding is we had about 1,000 who were very vocal in their opposition to even the thought that the Supreme Court would totally disregard the needs of pregnant people and their families to make their own decisions about their health care. And I have to say, it was heartening to me to see that 1,000 people showed up with handmade signs and full-throated support for the work that all of the organizations here in Utah do to help facilitate pregnant people and their families getting the services that they need.
Well, as it stands now, Utah has some very restrictive laws around abortion access. What does it look like now in Utah?
Well, for over 24 hours, I've been reminding people that abortion is still legal in Utah, still legal in the United States.
Right, for now. But how difficult is it for people to get an abortion in Utah now?
Well, our state legislature has made sure, I think we have all of what we call the trap laws. They have looked at every hoop that people should need to jump through to prove that they are worthy of making a personal decision about their reproductive health care. We have a 72-hour waiting period. We have state-mandated information that has to be face-to-face. But Planned Parenthood has worked to accommodate each of those regulations to fit into the real lives of women and their families.
So Utah passed this trigger law back in 2020, and it would go into effect if the Supreme Court does overturn Roe v. Wade. What happens? What does that trigger law look like?
Well, it depends what the Supreme Court rules and how it's worded, because our trigger law is specific as to how the upper court needs to rule for it to go into effect. But my guess is, and my hope is, that this legislature would call themselves into session. The trigger law passed in 2020 was passed quickly, I would say much too quickly and capriciously, to really look at the needs of the people and the families and the women of Utah in real life situations. And therefore, I hope they would come back into session before formalizing or encoding that trigger law and look at with compassion and reality how abortion, which is essential healthcare, would need to fit into the lives of women and families of Utah.
But if they don't, what does it look like?
It looks like there are very limited instances where a woman would be able to get an abortion. And as Planned Parenthood of Utah has looked at what the people of Utah think, they believe that there are more instances where a woman and the family need to be able to make private health decisions. And my guess is lawsuits will still continue to need to happen because, unfortunately, it's an expensive way for the legislature to learn that they have to listen to the people of Utah and what they need.
So would this trigger law allow abortions in the case of rape and incest or life of the mother or, you know, severe birth defects?
Life of the mother, it would. But very few other exceptions. And, you know, more than one doctor would have to certify for the health of the woman. Fetal anomalies are limited in what they would look at. It is not with the compassion that needs to happen.
Yeah. So are you anticipating women and pregnant people to try to go out of state? Next door, Colorado is a much more liberal state when it comes to this and allows abortion access. Would you facilitate women going across state lines?
As Planned Parenthood of Utah always has, we will facilitate and work with women and their families to figure out how to meet their health care needs. It is critical as part of our mission.
Given the fact that you have a Republican-controlled legislature and a Republican governor who opposes abortion, what is the likelihood of getting this law amended?
I'm an optimist, and I believe in the good of people. I've been working with Planned Parenthood since 1981, and a lot of things have changed. I will not doubt the power of the people to convince recalcitrant legislators of what is right and wrong. So for me to keep going on this, I've got to believe that we can at least take incremental steps to help elected lawmakers understand what the people need.
Carrie Galloway, CEO and president of the Planned Parenthood Association of Utah, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for asking.
Coming up, is California ready to accommodate an influx of women seeking abortions? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Branwell. If Roe v. Wade is overturned, California might see a huge influx of people coming from other states that pass strict anti-abortion laws or even outright bans. Thousands of people already come to California for abortions every year. This is a big state, and as you heard Governor Newsom say earlier in the show, not everyone who lives in California itself has had an easy time getting an abortion. As of 2017, 40% of counties in California had no abortion clinics, and that's about 3% of California women living in those counties. Joining us to talk about this is Ushma Upadhyay. She's an associate professor at UCSF's Bixby Center for Global Reproductive Health. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Carrie Franklin. She's a professor at the UCLA School of Law. Hi, Carrie.
Hi.
Ushma, let's begin with you. There are 185 abortion clinics in California, most in the more populated areas, which makes sense. But how far do women in the counties without clinics have to travel if they need an abortion?
We've done some analysis of the locations of the existing brick and mortar facilities, and there are, we're finding that, as you said, they are predominantly located in the major cities, Sacramento, San Francisco, San Diego, and Los Angeles. But in the eastern part of the state, there are no facilities. And then that also goes for the northern, anything north of Reading, there are no abortion providers.
So it must be hard for them to get to, let's say, San Francisco if they're in Reading.
Exactly. And so it's many hours of travel to get to an abortion provider. And that also comes with costs. Some people don't have cars or transportation. Having to take time off of work an entire day to reach an abortion provider, it's usually weekday only appointments. And so these distances create tremendous barriers for patients who need abortion care.
Well, would that mean that more of these women seek medication abortions in their own homes?
Yes. So we call them medication abortions because it is an abortion with pills. And in California, there is a new option available that just became available during COVID, which is telehealth abortions. We are finding, though, that people just don't know that this option exists yet. It tends to be higher income people, mm-hmm. more educated people who know that it is an option.
Right. Carrie, let me turn to you. The governor says he wants to expand care. He wants a state constitutional amendment to guarantee access. What would that entail?
Yeah, so there are a number of bills working their way through the legislature in Sacramento, and they do a range of things. One of the focuses of the bills is expanding the number of providers in California. There already is a lack of providers. And as more people come to California, we will need even more providers. So this will expand scholarships for people who can provide care, especially in the areas in the north and the east. There will be more funding through Medi-Cal and for providers who are providing abortions to people who can't pay for them. And then there's a constitutional amendment, which would we don't have the exact language yet, but it would write a right to reproductive health care and abortion into the Constitution.
And what could that possibly look like? Would it follow the Roe model, which would, limit the access to abortion to viability?
I don't think that that's what the provision will look like. We already have a provision for privacy in the California Constitution. And for a long time, that has been interpreted to protect people's reproductive rights, including access to abortion. So we currently have constitutional protection as interpreted by courts. This would make language in the Constitution, and it's not clear what the language would exactly be, but I would be very surprised if it limited it in the way that the Supreme Court has recently in terms of early abortions.
So it could go beyond 24 weeks or whatever is considered viable?
First of all, I should point out that the vast, vast majority, almost all abortions take place early on. There are situations where people's lives and health are at risk. There are situations where you have extremely medically and psychologically fragile patients. And there are instances in which abortion happens after the 15 weeks by which almost all abortions already occur. So we'll just have to wait and see what that language looks like.
And Ushma, from what you can see from the various proposals, would they go a long way to expanding access to women who you've already described have a difficult time getting an abortion?
Yes, I do think that they would. They're based on consensus from experts across the state regarding what is needed. It is based on recommendations from the California Future of Abortion Council. And so it was a very well thought out process, consensus-based, and it does go a long way into meeting the needs of Californians who need abortion care.
And what about the cost issue? Is that being taken care of adequately, do you think? Because as you mentioned, many women, not only in rural areas, but also in urban areas, find it difficult to pay for.
That's right. So currently, Medi-Cal for low-income people, Medi-Cal covers abortion fully. But people with insurance often have really high copays. We're talking hundreds of dollars sometimes. And insurance companies don't always cover abortion. And so there's a new law that requires abortion care to be available, accessible without copays or other costs. Mm-hmm. So that really will go a long way to help people get their abortion care.
And are you worried, though, that if there is an immediate huge influx, should these trigger laws go into effect, well, this summer, that that would strain services for California women until this new system is up and running?
I do expect the impact to be longer waiting times for people needing abortion care. I do think that the surge will delay people in accessing care. And one of the laws that is being deliberated now is additional funding for people who are out of state who can't afford abortion. It would provide coverage for them as well. So I think that protection that would be added as part of California being a sanctuary state for people needing abortions will allow people to get the care they need. And yes, that could create huge surges that will have an impact on waiting times.
Carrie, I'm wondering sort of a more theoretical big picture question. There are some states that are looking to criminalize women who travel across state lines to obtain an abortion. How would California, should it be, one of these places that these women go to, how would California fight that legally?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's one we will certainly be facing in the coming months and years. I think California is very aware of that and trying to ramp up protections for people here. The difficulty is when people return to their home states, but it really gives the lie to one of the suggestions that the anti-abortion forces have been making for a long time, that overturning Roe and returning the issue to the states would calm down the legal issues, because we're now actually going to enter a wild west of states fighting with each other, trying to extend their jurisdiction into other states. And this is somewhat uncharted territory, and we are going to be locked in legal battles for years to come over this.
Carrie Franklin teaches law at UCLA School of Law. Ushma Upadhyay is an associate professor at UCSF's Bixby Center for Global Reproductive Health. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, how one man is gentrifying the LA neighborhood of West Adams.
He turns something that didn't attract a lot of investment into something that does, and that involves displacement.
Shaul Kuba and how he curates neighborhoods, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. If you were to drive down West Adams Boulevard, south of the 10, just past Culver City, you'd see the typical signs of a neighborhood in transition. There are old liquor stores, empty lots, even some burn scars left over from the 1992 uprisings. But there is also a new boutique hotel. There's a pasta bar, some sleek apartment buildings under construction, a Mediterranean restaurant. The early signs of gentrification. However, all of these newly developed properties are owned by just one real estate firm, LA's CIM Group. The firm is working on at least 40 properties in the neighborhood right now as it looks to single-handedly redevelop West Adams into a trendy destination. Some longtime residents of this historically Black and Latino neighborhood feel they do not fit in to CIM's vision. Joining me to talk about this is Peter Waldman. He's an investigative reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, and he wrote about what's happening in West Adams. Welcome.
Thanks, Madeline.
Well, tell us about CIM. It's led by a guy named Shaul Kuba, and he's really the force behind this. Who is he?
So Shaul Kuba came over to the United States from Israel in the mid-80s. He came with a friend and fellow paratrooper after they both fought in the Lebanon-Israel War, and they settled in Los Angeles and were part of a great number of young Israelis in the building trades. and they turned out to be very successful at it. And one thing led to another over several years, and they became the leaders of a very large company with a lot of pension fund investments and other sources of money. And they manage and develop some $30 billion of real estate assets all over the country. And they're based right there in Los Angeles.
Wow. And it's not just that they're building these new structures. They're actually orchestrating who goes in them, right? To sort of like creating a neighborhood, not just building buildings, but designing what these neighborhoods will look and feel like. Like, who's going to be in there? What kinds of businesses?
Yeah, I mean, I spent a lot of time with Shaul Kuba, who, by the way, is a charismatic guy. And he, I think, fancies himself as kind of a curator as much as a developer. He chooses and remodels and refurbishes and designs in ways that are very creative and that tend to attract a lot of young creative types with expendable income who can pay for multi-$1,000 per month apartments in edgy places like West Adams.
Hmm. All right. So what does that mean for the people living there? This sounds like a typical tale of gentrification where things get more expensive and people who rent there and who've been there for maybe generations can't afford to live in their own neighborhoods anymore.
Yeah, I think the piece I set out to do in Bloomberg Business Week shows the nuances of what we call gentrification, which I believe is a really loaded word and means different things to different people. Mm-hmm. I call it transformation or remaking, or as they say in real estate, they call it placemaking. Shaul Kuba is a kind of master placemaker. He turns something that didn't attract a lot of investment into something that does, and that involves displacement. Not sort of with the bulldozer in most cases, because 25 of the 40 parcels that CIM Group is working on are adaptive reuse. So Shaul Kuba and the strategy there is all about preserving some of the quirkier industrial places and turning, let's say, this tire repair place into a Ms. Lala Middle Eastern Foods on West Adams. And they serve wonderful Middle Eastern food, and a lot of people like that.
Right.
But it's very different than it used to be.
But so what happens to the guy who repaired tires? Where does he go?
So in the story is a long vignette about a man who owns a liquor store on West Adams. It's called Holiday Liquors. And this person is an immigrant from Sierra Leone in Africa, has been in the United States for about 30 years and done very well both with liquor stores, but also as a home flipper himself. He fancies himself as a developer, and he's acquired two and now three parcels, including the liquor store. And Shaul Kuba and CIM Group has now offered him many millions of dollars twice for his properties, and he's rejected Shaul Kuba. And according to this gentleman, whose name is Mr. Abdul Sharif, he's been fighting and has had all kinds of troubles with the city attorney since rejecting CIM Group's offer.
So he's had troubles with the city attorney. That's Mike Feuer, who happens to be running for mayor. What do you mean by that?
So Feuer has been pretty aggressive for several years with something called nuisance abatement actions. And basically, if a policeman swears out an affidavit and says a landlord is allowing drug dealing or is indulging or somehow tolerating gang activity, they can force this landlord to do all kinds of things. So in the case of Abdul Sharif and Holiday Liquors on West Adams, there's a nuisance abatement injunction demanding all kinds of actions, like putting up video equipment and hiring security guards and not selling single receptacles of alcohol, all kinds of things that has made his business very uncompetitive with other liquor stores in that very area, who, by the way, also have crime problems but don't face any of these judicially imposed restrictions.
So is he saying that because he rejected Kuba's offer to sell out, Kuba then got the city attorney to harass him?
Yes, that is exactly the allegation.
What does Kuba say about that?
Kuba says he has nothing to do with Sharif's legal problems. And I'll note that is where the Cento pasta bar is located that Kuba just built for a pop-up Italian chef in Los Angeles. At the same time, they had to throw someone out of the building. They paid that person off $9,000. It happened to be a disabled veteran in his 70s who now lives part-time out of his car. But that's the kind of thing and the kinds of subtleties. People are enjoying this Italian restaurant, and this gentleman who lived there is out of luck.
So who wins in this battle? Do you put your money on Kuba?
The battle between Abdul Sharif and Holiday Liquor and CIM Group is pretty weighted toward not so much CIM Group because they're not the actual party there at play, but the city of Los Angeles and Mike Feuer and the city attorney. But let me add that Abdul Sharif is a pretty feisty immigrant as well, just like Shaul Kuba. And he isn't giving up. He's appealing the judicial injunction against Holiday Liquor. And he's also pursuing his own plans to develop a mixed-use, very CIM-style apartment retail complex right there on West Adams. So we'll see whether he can sort of build a rival real estate empire to CIM Group right there in the middle of West Adams.
Peter Waldman, investigative reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, where you can read his story on West Adams and all of the development that's happening there. Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, how television shows influence the way we see abortion. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In the aftermath of the draft opinion from Justice Samuel Alito indicating the Supreme Court will likely overturn Roe v. Wade in a case out of Mississippi, we're going to revisit a conversation about how television has shaped conversations about abortion and influenced public policy. Tanya Melendez is a researcher at the University of Illinois. She studies television, rhetoric, and public discourse. And I spoke with her late last year, right before the court heard oral arguments in the Mississippi case. Now, you wrote about this in a big essay for Vox, and the headline is How TV Lied About Abortion. And you go into several examples and several tropes, which we'll get into in a moment. But overall, when you look at what television does and what a good story does, it will rely on tension and conflict. And so when abortion is introduced as a storyline in general, how do they amp up the conflict as a narrative device for the sake of good storytelling? And how does that very idea of conflict, how does that influence how we view abortion?
That's the big question at the center of the piece is how television has created a moral framework around abortion that has given us a blueprint that we then take into our lives. So the overarching lie was that it is a debatable moral issue only, and that agency is taken away from the women main characters. What I mean by that is this. This is a story, a long story that begins in the 1960s. So abortion does not really appear on TV before 1980, except for two major exceptions. And I'm speaking specifically about primetime television, not soap operas, which have a different history with the procedure. But before 1980, we only have two instances. The first is the 1962 episode of The Defenders, which was a procedural, law procedural. And that episode was obviously a big deal, the mores of the time being what they were, but that wasn't even a main character having considerations about the procedure. It was a case. And so there was a large outcry against certain quarters. A few of the affiliates boycotted and refused to air the episode. But overall, it was a blip on the radar. But it was enough of a blip that we don't see abortion again until the 1972 episode of Maude. This is the Bea Arthur sitcom that was revolutionary television for its time.
We do have a clip of that. Actually, this was a two-part episode called Maud's Dilemma.
We're too old. I mean, it's not going to be any fun having a two-year-old who can beat you up the stairs.
There is no earthly reason for you to go through with this at your age.
It's legal in New York now, isn't it?
Mother, I don't understand your hesitancy. When they made it a law, you were for it.
Of course, I wasn't pregnant then.
I think it would be wrong to have a child at our age.
Just tell me, Walter, that I'm doing the right thing, not having the baby.
In the privacy of our own lives, you're doing the right thing.
That's 1972. It sounds radical today.
It does. And it was great, particularly because the entire episode was really built around the idea of whether or not she wanted to parent again, rather than being about whether or not the procedure itself was okay. And I think that's key. And it's unfortunate that that didn't open the floodgates then. Rather, it shut them down. We do not see abortion again for a while.
But when she says, Walter, just tell me I'm doing the right thing, not having the baby, she's not talking about it from a moral societal point of view, but from her own point of view of having a family.
Exactly. She's emphasizing her own agency. Tell me that we, as a married couple, that I am making the choice that is right for us.
That's interesting because I didn't read it that way.
How did you read it?
Well, as am I doing the right thing morally to terminate the pregnancy? And maybe that's an example of exactly what you're talking about how TV has influenced our views of abortion.
Yeah, I think it is, because there's no way to separate any sort of decision about family completely from morality, of course, right? These are family and parenting decisions, and that is part of our moral fabric and our moral fiber. The question is whether or not the decision is being made about your personal framework in that area, or if it's being discussed as a matter of public concern. And what I mean by that is we have a lot of examples of the way television begins to handle abortion in the 80s and 90s, where everybody gets to have input into the decision of a woman. And the difference between that and what I see is the progressive nature and the way she's speaking about it in Maud is that while Maud discusses this with her daughter, I believe that was one of the, in the clip, that was one of the characters speaking, is her grown daughter. While they're having those discussions, it is still centered around Maud's wants and desires, rather than trying to influence her in one way or the other, or to tell her that what she's doing is wrong. And those are the types of conversations we see later on in television happen much more frequently.
How much of this was the writers wanting to pursue these dramatic storylines versus the networks or the advertisers pressuring them to portray abortion in a negative light?
I'm not sure that anybody asked them to portray it in a negative light when we're talking about broadcast television. But certainly there was an emphasis in the 80s and 90s on equal time being had by all. I call it in the article both side storytelling. And both side storytelling was a way that a network could defend their decision to air a show. So there is a very famous episode of Cagney and Lacey, for example, that centers around an abortion plotline where the detectives have to investigate the bombing of an abortion clinic. And if you tally up the numbers at the end of the episode, exactly three major characters are pro-choice, and three major characters express anti-choice views, and everyone is presented extremely reasonably.
They can make me have this baby. I don't want to be on welfare. I want to finish business school.
I was raised Catholic. There are other choices besides abortion.
No one should tell Mrs. Herrera to have a child she doesn't want.
Look, Sergeant, if you were in Nazi Germany and you saw lives being taken by the thousands, wouldn't you do everything in your power to stop that?
I'm worried about the unborn. What about the babies that are already here? Do you think those people were picketing City Hall when daycare funding was cut?
And this comes across as a perfectly calibrated example of how to talk about abortion. And when CBS had to defend the show in a press release because there was threats of boycotts, as there always are sometimes around big episodes like this, that's what they said. We reviewed the episode and we feel it shows a balanced approach to the issue. So what that does, of course, is create a false equivalency between the people who would stop a woman exercising her constitutional right and the woman seeking her constitutional right. And that's a false equivalency because those two things are not equal. But that is what happens. So I'm not sure that anyone went out of their way to stress, make it look terrible. But I think that there was an earnestness to show both sides.
Right. So cut to the 90s and the teen drama Party of Five. And this is an example of one of the tropes that you write about that you entitle, "Phew, that was close."
Yes.
That plot line. In other words, they get that close to having an abortion and then something saves the girl from making the fateful decision. And here's a clip from Party of Five.
It was just an accident.
It's not going to change what I have to do about it. I mean, if my mom would have made the same choice as you, I wouldn't be here.
There are people who are going to say that it's murder. And you have to tell me what to say when they say that about you. You have to tell me how to answer them, please.
I had a miscarriage.
What?
So I didn't need an abortion.
Okay, what do you hear there? What's happening there? There are a lot of voices, but we hear the main character who is pregnant say that she had a miscarriage. The, "Phew, that was close" plot line, that she didn't have to go through with the abortion.
This is a typical plot line where an episode of television will allow a character to decide at the end of a long journey that amplifies the decision-making process. But at the end of that journey, she decides that she's going to have an abortion. But then before the procedure can actually take place, either there was a false positive test or she has a miscarriage. And what that does is allow the show to air ostensibly pro-choice views, but still be able to save the character from having the moral stain of having gone through the procedure. So Julia, a 16-year-old who was using protection, got accidentally pregnant with her boyfriend, in this episode has conversations and scenes with every other main cast member, including, as you heard, a very young sister, where they all feel free to give her input into what she should be doing. So this becomes a matter of her having to go through this decision-making process with everyone in her life in order to be able to make the choice that she wanted to make from the beginning anyway. And then she doesn't go through with the procedure, of course, because she doesn't have to, but still manages to express guilt for wanting to have the procedure in the first place.
You didn't do anything, Julia.
But I can't act like the choice was taken out of my hands. I mean, I would have made the choice, Justin. It was the least worst of a lot of bad options, and I would have done it.
So even though she did not have the procedure, she's still assuming the guilt she assumes she should be feeling for even considering it.
Right. And as you say, she's doing this in a much more public arena than Maude was doing.
Yes, exactly.
And the implicit assumption there that the right moral best decision would have been to have the baby.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that television did for a really long time was make abortion the enemy of motherhood. And this is an important thing to note because these are not binary decisions and they're not one against the other. As a matter of fact, most people who have abortions in America already have children. They are mothers. And this is not a decision that's being made in the context of how a woman feels about mothering, but rather whether or not they are choosing to have a baby. That is a different conversation from the way we perceive of motherhood in our culture. But television is very, very quick to position abortion as the enemy of motherhood.
It's interesting that you also write about Roseanne, and we'll hear a clip from that in just a second. But I see Roseanne as almost kin to Maude in a sense. I think she's a strong woman at the center of a family drama who is unapologetically complicated and intelligent and also ends up in one episode getting pregnant. And she also already has children. She's pro-choice as well. And yet Roseanne has a very different approach to this situation. Can you talk about it, and then we'll hear the clip from the episode?
Sure. Yes, this is an episode, or a this is actually two episodes as well, where Roseanne's character gets unexpectedly pregnant. And what's great about it is that you're right. She does represent a much more realistic picture of who seeks abortion in this country. She is low income. She has not graduated college. She already has children. This is all very much in line with the statistics of who seeks abortion. The problem becomes that in order to make the episode have dramatic stakes, the writers chose to have her have an amniocentesis that is unclear, meaning that there is a potential for fetal abnormalities. And so at that moment, Dan and Roseanne, who have had this previous discussion, immediately start talking about having an abortion. Apparently, they had agreed to this in the past, that if there was an abnormality in a pregnancy, that that's what they would do. So the episode is centered around her conflicts, both with her spouse, about changing her decision-making process, but also trying to figure out for herself whether or not she can carry a pregnancy that has an abnormally developing fetus.
Okay, here's a clip. Here's a clip of her talking with Jackie, her sister, about this.
This nurse down at the clinic said there might be something wrong with the baby.
Oh my God, what?
I don't know.
Well, it is lucky that you're so early in the pregnancy.
Yeah, it's not that early, Jackie. I heard the heartbeat. You know, I always thought that I could have an abortion, but now I don't think I can.
And what to you is troubling about that? Because I think that's probably something a lot of women go through, this feeling of ambivalence and of emotional distress if they hear a heartbeat.
Of course. And I agree with you. Yeah, I think it's probably out there and it probably happens. The problem is that when you're talking about representation on television, this isn't one of hundreds of different types of stories being told. This is part of a larger group of stories. And in this trope, what happens is that the show articulates positions of choice, but explicitly highlights the values of childbearing, of mothering, in the face of a potential threat to these values that abortion actually represents. So what it's doing, again, is making abortion the enemy. The only reason why there is conflict in this episode is not because that the baby might face challenges or that the pregnancy might end through natural causes. The conflict in this episode becomes whether or not she has chosen to go through with the procedure or not. So it has very little to do with that part of the process that many women probably do face, which is that ambivalence. It really comes down to a binary decision between abortion or being a good mother.
And then she has the baby. And
yeah, because it turns out that the next amniocentesis proved that the baby was fine. So that's that.
And how is it now? How is television handling it now? Is it changing in any way?
It's gotten better. It really has. Yeah, the big shift comes around 2010. That is when you start seeing stories that really start to center a woman's agency. And the biggest one that really kicks off this wave of storytelling is by Shonda Rhimes during Scandal. So she had Grey's Anatomy and Scandal at the same, and you know, overlapping periods in television, and both had abortion plot lines. But in particular, the abortion plot line on Scandal is a really great example of how TV can do this well, which is the protagonist of the show, who is a Black woman and currently having an affair with the president of the United States, because it's Scandal, gets pregnant. And at no time do we see the moment she finds out about the pregnancy. We don't see her making the appointment. She doesn't discuss it with anyone. But what you do see is her going to a medical facility, being put into the actual gown and cap, laying on the table. And then we see her face as the vacuum aspirator machine works. The scene is about a minute long. It's incredibly respectful. And more importantly, it's about the medical process. It's a medical framework and a medical gaze. It's intensely respectful of the woman's choice being sacrosanct and above any other part of the drama. And if this is a soap opera that loves dramatic moments, so the seriousness in which this was taken to show how it is a private decision is extremely intentional. And when this was successful on ABC in primetime, a network owned by Disney, this opens a lot of doors. Particularly female showrunners and executive producers and writers start to create these stories that are really centering women. And it becomes much more common nowadays to see the decision-making process be minimized and actually demonstrate more storytelling options in how a woman seeks abortion, how they choose to talk about it with other people, how that they either include or not include others, but not the decision itself. And the morality itself is much less debated now. And it's much more about how the right to choose is executed by women across the country in different spaces. So it's been a big shift in storytelling. And there's still plenty of examples of it not being handled well. But a tide was turned, and we're starting to see better storytelling happen.
But there wasn't people saying, okay, you have to tone this down because we're Disney, or we have our advertisers to worry about. We can't generate controversy because this is, you know, a controversial topic. Like, I'm just wondering if that pressure was at all to bear in the writers' rooms.
Oh, I'm sure. We know, for example, that on Party of Five, the actual original script had Julia getting the abortion. Amy Littman, who was an executive producer, has been very open in press that she wanted Julia to have the abortion because she thought that's what a 16-year-old in her situation would do. But they were asked by Fox not to have the abortion at all. So that was an example where a network completely simply vetoed the procedure being shown on their network. And I'm sure that's happened more than once. But in general, this is a time where shows really embrace talking about more realistic issues. The 80s start doing a series of what, you know, the special episodes and arcs that deal with a variety of things that we were just starting to figure out we should be talking about on television because of the mass power of the medium. So things like domestic violence were talked about, and alcoholism and homelessness and HIV/AIDS, all of these things start coming across our television screens. The difference between them and abortion, honestly, is for every other issue, shows really articulated a strong opinion on a progressive landscape. They told you who was right. They told you who was wrong. And there's something about this particular topic in America where people feel very reluctant to be able to draw those lines, particularly back then. And what happens in the storytelling when you have a lot of storytellers who are white men, because remember, that's who wrote and produced television for most of its history until pretty recently, frankly, you have a lot of people who don't know how to talk about abortion in a way that really shows what abortions are like. Instead, they know how to talk about it from the dramatic storytelling ideals that they were trying to bring into the room. And so you get really bad plot lines that don't actually take place around the process and take place much more around, is this a bad thing or a good thing? And we don't want to tell you what that is.
And you see that direct line between these plot lines and what's happening at the Supreme Court right now.
Yeah, I really do. I think that the way television treated abortion raised multiple generations, not just one, raised multiple generations to believe this is a debatable issue and that everyone has the right to intercede their opinion into a woman's right to choose. I think we were taught that women should feel badly because every woman we saw felt badly. I think we were taught that women regret their abortions, which we know from data is not true. These are not the way abortions actually happen in our world, but that's the way we were taught they did happen or should happen or would happen. And when you absorb those lessons for decades, when you are raised thinking that's what it looks like, you vote according to those values. You think about abortion in those ways. And yet this is a procedure that we know 1 in 3 women will have. And we know that women who seek abortions don't regret it. And we know that when women have access to safe, accessible abortion, they are happier, more productive. They go on to have other children. They raise families. And yet, when that's not what we're told actually happens on television, we absorb those lessons. And those people grow up and they make laws and they vote for people and they fight for the values they were taught they should have.
Well, Tanya, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming on the show today.
This was great. Thank you so much for having me.
Tanya Melendez from the University of Illinois, and you can read her essay. It's called How TV Lied About Abortion at the Vox website. Hey, guess what? You're listening to KCRW on our very first day of our spring pledge drive. Woohoo! We're kicking things off with a big challenge today, $25,000. Help us raise $25,000 by midnight tonight. And one of our champions, Murat Sehideglu, will match your donations, making it a total of $50,000 just for us. Yay! So please do that today, kcrw.com/give. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.